from Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in Available, Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk gaming and game development.
I'm Ellen Burns-Johnson, and I make nice games.
I'm Steve McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Martha Croy, I too make nice games.
For this week's episode, our topics are maintaining an open source project and killers, who needs them? And so, if everyone is ready, let's start. So I went to Summer Games Done Quick. Just going to start off right away saying that.
Yay! Was
which
it fun?
You've been threatening to do that for years.
Yeah, it's true.
Finally did it.
I've always wanted to, well, because it, you know, it happens, Summer Games Done Quick happens in Minneapolis. Because we have a relatively large speedrunning community. I keep finding out that people I've known for a while.
Is that the reason? I always thought it was just the organizer just happened to be from here.
I think it's a combination of the two.
Oh, okay.
Because we have a sizable speedrunning community that organizes.
Okay.
And I keep finding out that like people I have known for a long time do speedrunning, but like on the couch.
This is an open call to everyone out there. Stop hiding these facts from Steven.
Yes. Gosh, it's rude. So it was really interesting because, you know, Summer Games Done Quick hasn't been on in person for a while because of COVID.
Yeah.
And so it was cool to be able to go in person for the first time. So I was part of the audience. You can hear my voice at certain parts, probably during the Kirby and the Forgotten Land speedrun. That was my favorite. That's great.
Real quick, speaking of live in person, you were saying how impressed you were with their COVID protocols.
Yes. So, you know, a lot of events are, you know, making sure that people are vaccinated and they, you know, you have to send that proof initially ahead of time. And so, like, they did that. But they also, like, cut attendance in half, maybe a little less than half than they normally was. So, like, I think they normally have it open for like 2,500 people. They cut attendance to like 1,200 people, something like that. All of the seats at the event were spaced out 6 feet away from everyone. And they were enforcing during the event, like making sure people were sitting away because people would like move their chairs close to one another. Because I mean, you oftentimes would come with people. Like I didn't go by myself. I went with my brother and Reese, who's been on the show before. You know, we tried to sit together and somebody was like, no, you can't do that. You got to sit in another chair. So like, and they also had like people cleaning the seats regularly too.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, it was very impressive, to see how seriously they were taking it.
Yeah.
And it made me very comfortable being there.
That enforcement, tale you told us, that's the thing that impressed me the most is that I think a lot of times these things, and certainly as the pandemic has gone on, it's become just a list of bullet points pasted to a door,
right?
You know,
yeah.
So it's nice that they actually just like, no, we're actually going to take it seriously.
Yeah.
And I mean, good because it does change the event.
Yeah.
But like,
it really did.
Risk is lower now, but I think it doesn't hurt the experience so much to have those restrictions enforced.
Yeah.
And so I'm glad someone's doing it for an event like this.
I mean, I will say that like during some of the larger, more people were attending some of the events, it was difficult for them to enforce it in those situations.
I did see that at the very end, it looked like it was a little bit more crowded, but my guess is they saw that coming and like, but I was seeing earlier on, we really were, people were very far apart. Even on the couch.
Yeah. They don't have a couch. They had like 2 seats. Mm-hmm. 6 feet apart from one another. Everybody who was speedrunning was also wearing masks. You know, masks were enforced, and they had you wearing the specific kinds of masks that are better, not just like plain cloth masks.
Yeah.
But like the KN95s and such.
Mm-hmm.
They gave everybody N95 masks, like 4 N95 masks that you could use.
Oh, really? Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Because that makes enforcement easier.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Everybody has one. It was really cool. And you know, you went to a lot of the things. It was a whole, you know, it's a whole week. It's kind of interesting going to Summer Games Done Quick, like actually being an attendant there. Cause like when you're there, you're just watching the event instead of like how I normally would have it is just like up on the, in the background while I'm working or what have you.
Was it somewhat underwhelming in a way?
No, it wasn't. It was a little underwhelming only in that, like, because everybody was spaced out from one another, it was difficult to like have conversations about the run.
Right. Right.
Which, you know, it was a sacrifice, but I'm happy to do that for safety purposes. But
fewer high fiving.
Yeah, fewer high fives. but it was more that it was like I had to travel. It's technically in Bloomington, not in Minneapolis. So I had to travel from my place to Bloomington when I wanted to go. So it was a bit of a hassle to coordinate that with everybody else who wanted to go with.
Yeah.
And then, like, when you're there, it's cool and type and stuff. But then you're like, oh, I don't know if I want to stay for this event or for this next speed run. Like, all the speed runs, even when you're there, are entertaining because you're still part of the crowd and it mm-hmm. get more hype. But, like, I don't know. You get tired after a certain point because people need sleep. So it was just like it was a bit of an adjustment, more of an adjustment than I would have expected. Mm-hmm. But it was cool. You can see me and my brother walking across the stage during the what was it called?
Alan, he rushed the stage.
I didn't rush.
And he's admitting to it too.
I didn't rush it. I walked past.
And there's evidence and everything.
Oh my gosh!
We gotta find this.
Wild man.
It was Kaizo Super Mario or Super Metroid. Kaizo Super Metroid.
Mm.
Yeah. Me and my brother walked across it a few times, so you can see us during that speed run. yeah, it was a fun time. I am not sure if I will go again next year, mm-hmm. but I will seriously consider it because I did have a good time. It was mm-hmm. a fun time.
Yeah, maybe it's one of those things where, like, you've done it now.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm thinking. But I mean,
it might become a tradition. You haven't decided yet.
Yeah, I haven't decided yet. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We'll see next year.
Yeah.
Ellen, your
100th
episode is coming up soon.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Whoa.
What?
Yeah, we've been counting.
I'm old now.
Now, we're not good at calendar math, but we are.
Yeah, we're not going to guarantee this count, but we have been counting.
Yeah, we're pretty decent at regular math, so we can count up from 1 to 100.
Steven, don't make promises.
Calendar math is like counting in a different base or something.
Yeah,
it's just
exactly.
like this weird skill that only astronauts have. And we don't have it because we're not astronauts.
This is episode 270.
Yes.
Yeah.
And which is your 100th?
Supposedly.
Yes.
272.
Yeah. So that's going to be in 2 weeks, folks.
Yeah. Whoa. This is Ellen's 100th hosting, I think. Not Ellen's 100th, because I think that would...
Right. You were on two episodes maybe three.
This would be like 100th episode, I guess, from a different count. But we're not counting that one. That's not the for real.
I forgot all my party streamers. Well, you're going to plan something fun and goofy for us. And you can do whatever you want, right?
More fun and goofier.
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that was a
one standard deviation away from the norm.
Yes, maybe more than, yeah. Same show, but yeah, it'll be fun.
Yeah.
It'll be fun. Maybe snacks, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Oh, probably we get snacks?
Not on the air, though. That's gross.
So stay tuned for that. I'm particularly excited because I don't have to do any prep.
Yep. Same. Just
oh no.
Always a great show for me.
Let me be clear. I'm not gonna do any prep either.
We'll just have our regular conversation on the air. That'll be fine.
Well, you guys will find it. It'll be fun.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
In more Ellen news.
Yeah. Oh yeah. So I thought you were gonna. There's a bullet point right here that you could have read.
For you to read.
Yeah,
instead, you gave me
it's
these
Ellen's
eyebrows.
News.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So I got into a cool club. I got into the DALL-E 2 beta. So DALL-E is, and we'll link it in the show notes. It's this, it's an algorithm that lets you use natural language. When I say natural language, like the way that you would say a phrase, you type it into the prompt, the input, and it spits out an image of what you described.
Yeah.
And it uses some pretty cool stuff like adversarial techniques or something like that. So it's like basically it's almost like it's this AI is basically two AIs talking to itself,
mm-hmm.
and it games against itself. So like one is trying to trick the other one, and the other one's trying to guess what the first one did. And so it's we can also try to find some good reading on it and link that in the show notes because I probably didn't do it justice. But the real point is it's got some really cool stuff. So I've been like popping in there a couple of times a day and generating weird stuff. And I put some of these weird photos that I generated at the bottom of our episode script so you can see what I did.
Okay.
And we'll include some of these in the show notes as well on the page so you can see what's here. I made a very scary looking teddy bear with dragon wings and demon eyes.
That was the prompt, scary looking teddy bear with it. Look, I mean, the thing, it's incredible with how these things look. They really do look handmade. Now, I think a lot of people listening have probably heard of DALL-E Mini, which is something that is available to everybody, and it's a less robust version of this algorithm, and that's pretty impressive. Mm-hmm. But you can tell they're generated images.
Yeah,
I mean, unless you really go and look at the pixels, it's very difficult to know that these are computer generated.
Yeah.
They seem like original pieces of work.
They do. And some of them are, some of the ones that I've shared also have, are easily, they're even better. Like what I did with this one to get to the teddy bear is I typed in a sentence that was just 3D render of a teddy bear with dragon wings and fire eyes. And it put out some things that look a little goofy.
Uh-huh.
And then what you can do is you can actually like target specific parts of specific images and have it re-render.
Oh, okay.
And it'll make it, it'll get better.
Oh, so there's, and that also trains the model.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yep. So I put this particular teddy bear was the result of one cycle of that kind of iteration. So mm-hmm. I could have gone through a couple, and some of the demo images that I'm seeing on, like if you go onto the front page, it'll show you all these like demo images. I'm assuming that those are like the result of a few different iterations mm-hmm. in that certain way, but it took me like less than 5 minutes to make this teddy bear.
That's incredible.
And it's really cool and now, very scary.
There's two interesting things about this project that I think it's like, is it going to put artists out of work? And I'm fairly certain no, it won't do that.
No.
And not just because there's always going to be more art. It's because algorithm like this, it can only synthesize. It can't really create.
Right.
And so what it is, you know, you can train the model on a lot of things, but it only knows what exists.
Right.
Right. So it can only build. And that's actually quite true of a human's creative process as well. But there is something that that creation we can do is just a little bit better than what these things can do. And it's interesting. I've seen some of the examples posted online and you can kind of tell when they're described in a certain way that how the prompt is very specific.
Mm-hmm.
There's no room for interpretation, essentially.
Right.
And it looks like a mix of things that are described and if something looks strange, it's because the model that part of the model it went to find those things biased it in that way.
Yeah.
And that's the other interesting thing about this is the level of bias is based on the input that's provided.
Exactly.
Right. And it's something that the researchers have put a lot of thought into. If not solving, because it's a hard problem to solve, at least preempting the discussion about it. They want people to know that this model is biased,
mm-hmm.
that it reflects a lot of the racist and sexual discrimination that is part of our culture.
Mm-hmm.
And they have checks, supposedly, for users of mm-hmm. the model to prevent against abuse.
Okay.
But the model itself can be a vector for abuse.
Sure.
Just by generating images that reflect and reinforce these bits of culture.
That is fascinating.
It's very, it's dangerous yeah. material, but it's just reading about their understanding of it and their kind of acknowledgement that there's only so much they can do, mm. which is, I think, worthy of criticism.
Sure.
But it's very interesting. It's part of their FAQ on their website that we'll link in the show notes.
Yeah.
But I find it utterly fascinating because really what it is it synthesizes what's available.
So I have a direct example of that very thing.
Yeah.
So I actually inserted another one here. We were trying to see how stock photo-y we could get this thing to create stock photos. And so I typed in stock photo of a businessman at his desk. They are all with middle-aged white dudes,
yeah.
right? Like, I didn't specify that, but that's what came out as a default because that's what it's learning from,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
It's having worked with a lot of stock photos, not a great supply of, like, people of color in business settings,
right.
which is really frustrating
mm-hmm.
For many people for lots of different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a direct result of that, you know? So we had I was chatting about this with my husband. We had a really good conversation about that.
Gosh, none of these people look excited at all.
Also something worth noting. The default businessman is a bored white dude in a blue-green collared shirt.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. Interesting.
So scrolling down, I did the prompt was 1800s photograph of a laborer in front of an empty railroad.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
It really didn't do the faces well.
No, it did not.
Like, there are no faces. It's quite horrifying to look at, actually.
Yeah.
And sometimes the railroad gets a little weird.
Yeah, there's one where the rail goes right around him.
Yeah.
Splits and goes right around him.
That's not how that works.
Yeah. But there you go. You know, laborer, again, a male figure. But also the 1800s photograph, the data set it goes to doesn't have clear images. And so it doesn't quite understand that you still are looking for a human person.
Right.
Rather than a person who appears in these photographs as they appear. So it's like you can tell where it catches up. And, you know, those things that language processing can be improved.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's a lot of what you're describing. You train the model by being part of this.
Right. And that's what, right. Exactly. That's what the beta is for, is to get some real chumps like myself to come in here and do things like make me broccoli at the dentist, which is one of the last picture that I included in here. Broccoli at the dentist's office is at the bottom of the document. And I think it created
a couple of them have eyes, they're anthropomorphized, which see that reflects the phrasing. If you were to ask somebody to draw a broccoli at the dentist's office, they would imagine a sort of a cartoon scenario. Mm-hmm. And so it you can see that it's picked up on that because our culture would produce something
exactly,
like that.
Exactly. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, it's really interesting.
That's so cool.
I think the other few that we don't have to mention these specifically, but like I did a woodblock style one. I asked it to like render a few different ideas in the style of some different artists. So like Tamara de la, I'm not going to pronounce his name right. Tamara de Lempicka? Mm-hmm. Lempicka? Lempicka. Anyway, she's the one, she painted herself, it's called like auto portrait. It's like a self portrait of her driving a green Bugatti. Mm-hmm. And so I told it to do Cat in a Green Bugatti by Tamara de Lempicka. Mm-hmm. And it did that. I think it did it pretty well. Like, there's definitely some things that need to be iterated on. One of these cats is directly coming out of the hood. That's not right. But it's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And it does reflect the style. It's not just making photographs. It's not making realistic renderings. It's really just making whatever you tell it to.
I could have told it to do a cat driving a green Bugatti as a photograph, and it would have done that. So I also had to do the Mona Lisa, but with a soda can instead of a woman. And what it produced was basically like Coke ads, but it made up new soda names for the soda.
Oh yeah.
So it says like Lona, Loma,
Lasona,
Mona, Lasona.
I'm pretty sure one of those says oily. I don't think I drink that.
I don't think that's a real word.
Fascinating.
And then my favorite one was businessman at his desk in the style of Egon Schiele. Who's one of my favorite artists, and I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his name right either. But I thought it just really nailed the style, and also like some of the poses were just so evocative. Like, we were looking at the businessman earlier, and all them looks just like, and they just look bored, and they had their blue green shirts on. And here it's like, because this artist was so expressive in the way that he posed people, mm-hmm. like it's really picked up on that. And now you've got like a businessman who's like, seems like he's about to flip the table over or like is just moping and melting on the side of, I don't know. It's just really interesting.
Yeah.
So we'll share those images on the mm-hmm. show notes, and you guys can give me ideas about what I should pop into this thing.
What's so exciting is, talking with the team on Dream Settler, we are producing a fake internet. So, mm-hmm. And we're also heading into the MySpace era, the time we're talking
about.
And so we're talking about things like profile pictures and just large quantities of images that we need to produce that are supposedly from different characters in the game. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the solution to this, has been commissions. Mm. Getting a lot of people to contribute small amounts of work for mm-hmm. as much consideration as we can provide.
Yeah.
And that's still, a big part of it. But also we do need just gobs of data that are not specific. Yeah. And so we've looked at some of these tools as a way to get us halfway there, and we can tweak or modify. Because one of the things about these computer generated images is that they do not hold any copyright. That's one of the few like facts of modern, the modern digital age that related to copyrights that is a settled question. Mm-hmm. The code, the product to make them is you can copyright or patent a product or a process or a method.
Yeah.
But the actual art generated is owned by no one, and it's a boon to developers who need content. And the better that these tools are, the more we can use them to create not just gobs of data, but actually things we want. Yeah. And so it's not going to be able to fully texture your 3D model yet, but that is where it's going. And so the question is like, is it going to replace artists? It's no, but it will replace a lot of labor, a lot of art labor.
Yeah, that's a good way to phrase it.
And I think that, since Photoshop, it's always been like, it unlocks my creativity. So having all these tools, it doesn't have to be threatening.
Right.
But it also means that there's going to be a lot of content generated by people who are not artists, and you'll probably be able to tell. Not because the quality is any worse, which is the old way you used to be able to tell, but that it doesn't coalesce into a vision or a concept.
Right.
And mm-hmm. because it lacks an artistic sensibility.
It'll look familiar.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's another use of a tool like this, is to make things that does look familiar.
Yeah.
Right. And that's what that's sort of our aim for.
That's what you want to do.
Is we want it to be specific and something that is known to people, just sort of curated by us. Well, also, we are creating a crazy amount of original assets as well.
Yeah.
So we've really looked into this. And so, like, it's pretty cool that you got access, because I may have to borrow the wheel one afternoon.
We cut that part of the podcast out if we need to. No, that sounds awesome. And my first project, personal project that I'm going to be using it for, is to do new D&D character portraits.
Yeah.
Because we're starting a new campaign. We're actually using a different system. My playgroup, we're going to switch to Savage Worlds, and we're going to try that out. But still need to do the character portraits, because how can you roleplay a character if you don't have a detailed portrait of them and a detailed backstory that's at least 5 pages long?
At least.
Yeah, there's AI that can give you that, too.
That's not, you know.
There's some lines you don't cross.
Why even play the game, then? So, like, we've done, like, a third of an episode already. Should we get onto the round
table? I'd say so.
Yeah.
Sometimes there's just some interesting things that happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
Man, these images. Yeah, we'll put these in the show notes. They're really, really interesting.
For sure. We'll probably come back to this as the project develops and we learn more about it and I come up with better pictures of broccoli.
Well, speaking of open source projects, which is the core of DALL-E, open AI algorithm, mm-hmm. I'm going to be talking about maintaining your own open source project.
Wow.
And so I've mentioned this in the show a little bit in the past year that I made a game engine for Playdate. And it's an open source code library that sits on top of the Playdate SDK, helps you manage scenes, helps you manage sprites, does a lot of the things that a game engine does. But the SDK for Playdate is so robust that it doesn't need to do that much. And that's why it was within scope for me to make. I've talked about that on the show before. I think we put my talk about it as an episode a while back. We'll put that in the show notes. But I want to talk about what it takes to maintain a project when it's sort of out and other people might want to, one, use it, but also might want to contribute their own code to it.
Right.
And this is just a bunch of learning for me. Like, I'm not good at this, but I know how to do it now.
Okay.
So I can kind of give you my, just the 101 on how it works and how I've approached it and some of the problems that you might face that you wouldn't expect.
Yeah.
So this is going to be very GitHub focused. Okay. You can, you know, open source doesn't require any tools whatsoever to be open source, but to actually make use of it, you're usually going to use Git and you're going to use a Git hosting service like GitHub.
Okay.
And GitHub has a lot of specific tools that I'm going to be referring to. So that's where my experience begins and ends for this side of things. But a couple of general things that I learned pretty quickly was I needed to have this project exist inside of another project for me to be able to work on it. And so people have heard me talk about it before know that I made it for the Widget Satchel sequel I'm making for Playdate.
Yeah.
And that's how it started. I was making enough helpers and libraries and stuff for that game that I broke it out, turned it into an engine, and then that became its own project.
Mm-hmm.
But I needed to bring it back into the not just to use it for the game, but to actually develop the engine itself. I needed to have a working game around it. At least for me anyway, I found it very difficult to develop it in isolation, because you need to be able to test and iterate just as quickly as you do any code you're working on a game.
Right.
And I don't have the experience doing it any other way. So I think the solution for that, because what happens is if you maintain a library that's open source and you don't want your game code in there, right? Widget Satchel 2 is not going to be an open source game.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Even though a big part of it is going to be this project.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way around it is using something called Git submodules.
Oh, okay.
So either of you know what that is?
I've not heard of this before.
It sounds like a Star Trek thing.
It does. And it's one of the reasons I took to it so quickly. No. So basically, it's a way to put a Git repo inside another Git repo. Oh,
okay.
And it's one file that references...
That was my brain all over the podcast.
So the code for the actual of the embedded library, the submodule, exists in a folder somewhere in your main project.
Right.
That's not any different. But instead of a .git folder in there, you've got a file that references a project the commit of another project.
Oh,
which says okay. Everything in this folder is matches a status from another repo.
Uh-huh.
So when you make changes to the main project, you can pull them in to your other project, the submodule of the other project.
Yeah.
And then the only thing that changes in your main project is that one file that just points to a different commit.
Okay, I see.
Even though all the files still exist, right? They're ignored by your main project.
Yeah.
So I don't think I've described that very well. But basically, that's helpful for me in terms of developing the thing. But also, it's extremely useful when you're using somebody else's library. Because what that means is that if you have your own project on a Git repo, a private one of your own,
yeah,
and the engine code is in a subfolder, or a library folder somewhere, or not just the engine, any library,
right?
You're probably not going to make any changes to that because it's not, that's a library, you don't touch it.
Yeah.
But if the maintainers make a change to it, make an update, how do you get that updated code in your project?
Right.
You can download the latest version and replace it and blah blah blah.
Yeah.
But the sort of more elegant way of doing it is in your project, you have that project as a submodule. So when it gets updated, you pull those changes directly.
And you pull that separately?
Yes. So so I use Fork, which is a Git client.
I've been using that too.
It's pretty good, right?
I like it in a lot of ways, and a few ways I don't.
But well, I describe it as source tree, but working.
Mm. Sure, so that's fair.
It's very familiar to people who've used source tree, which is by far more popular. Mm. Basically, and source tree works the same way, I believe.
Yeah.
You have just in the left toolbar somewhere, you just have all the submodules in your project.
Oh.
Double click that sucker, opens up a new tab, and there's the project.
Oh.
And it just exists, and it exists in your. So if you do make changes,
yeah.
Yeah, that's the other good thing is if you do make changes to the library in your larger project, mm-hmm. you can still push them to just the library's repo.
Oh, sure. Oh, okay.
That's very useful for me. So my local copy of Noble Engine is inside the library folder of Widgets Agile 2. Mm. And then when I want to make changes, I'm usually making it inside a working game that I can compile and run.
Yeah.
But instead of having to remove all that code each time or ignore all the stuff around it,
right.
it's just the repo just exists inside the other repo. And so I just double click it. It opens it there as if it's its own thing. Mm-hmm. And I push and pull as I need.
Okay.
So so you can maintain, you can do this for multiple projects. You can have the library in three or four projects and you can make a change in any of them and push it. And then on the other three, you just pull them back down.
Wild. Okay. That's cool.
Yeah. It's very intuitive, but it does take a little while to figure out.
Sure.
And then once you do, it's pretty good.
Okay.
But I think that's one thing I learned that is just like necessary for maintaining a project like this, especially if it's going to be a library that is going to be in other people's projects.
Yeah.
So the other reason it's really beneficial is for when other people use it, they get those advantages, but it makes it just much easier for you to teach people how it works.
Mm.
And also in my case, I'm much more comfortable giving code to people that's not finished.
Yeah.
Because the thing about Noble Engine is that it's usable. It's 100% fine. Mm-hmm. It's got a couple bugs here and there that you can work around them.
Sure.
But I wouldn't call it done.
Yeah.
I have not made a release of it. And I'll talk about releases on GitHub in a minute. So I'm able to let people have it because I'm not worried about orphaned old code getting stuck in people's projects. Which, if you use, say, the Unity Asset Store, sometimes you don't want to update stuff because it works fine and you're fine with it, right?
Yes.
and so I'm happy to leave that choice up to the people who use it. If they're fine with it, they don't need to update the engine. But I don't want to strand anybody or stick them with an old version that I know is not finished.
Yeah.
Because I'm probably going to make some changes that break things. Mm. And so I want to make sure that like everyone has the opportunity, if they are an early adopter of my library, that it's easy enough for them to do it.
Okay.
It does create a little more demands on the documentation because you have to explain, no, don't download this project. Go to my template project, download that. Because that's the other thing I did for it is that I made a GitHub template, which is sort of a one-click operation to start a new project locally. If you use the GitHub desktop application, it's really integrated, but even from the website, which is how I use it, it's pretty simple.
Okay.
A template will then clone your project, and inside the template, it's a playdate game template that I've made that has a Noble Engine submodule in it. Mm-hmm. So basically, I'm advising people to just start with that rather than download the engine or clone the engine itself.
Yeah.
Because the engine has some opinions on where things go in libraries and stuff. Like this, you'll find this with other game engines that like they work a certain way or they have special folders. Noble Engine is kind of like that. Like you have to put it in library/Noble because that's what the code expects it to be.
Yeah.
Right. And so unlike, say, Unity, where every file in it is imported in a process, it gets a GUID, and so you can move things around.
Yeah.
That's a really complicated process, but the upshot is that you don't necessarily have to worry where files are located all the time. There's less it's hard-coded that way because they maintain the same identity, essentially.
Yeah.
A lot of code-only projects don't have that luxury. Right. And so the template project is provided, I provide to set up, help people get started.
Okay,
because
cool.
One of the important things I think about when you want people to use your stuff is make it as easy as possible.
Right. Because otherwise people will get confused and they'll bother you about it. And it's a whole thing. Right.
Right. And you'll deserve the bother.
Yeah. Like, yeah. But I mean like and people won't, it's the same thing with video games, right? You got to make sure it's usable. Otherwise people won't bother with it. There needs to be a way to introduce yourself into the thing. So I think that makes
you're
sense.
Giving them this thing for free,
right?
But the thing is, they're also giving you a lot of trust.
Yeah,
and so I think I don't think it's unfair to expect. I mean, I'm kind of big on documentation, so it's maybe easier for me to say this because I ideologically feel this way.
Sure.
Because documentation is not easy. Man, so many open source projects. You download them, and then you're like, "What do I do with this?"
Right. Yeah.
And that's like that's normal, and it's like I can't. I mean, it happens so often that obviously it's not. Like you can't. Blame everybody. There's another reason for that. It's that it's hard.
Right. Yeah.
But if you can make good instructions, if you can explain what it is, and that's leading to the next thing that I think is really valuable is making sure that you have good documentation that's in the code, that you have a system which can generate legible documentation in an HTML page and use tools like GitHub Pages to host that.
Oh.
There's a whole technical angle to that I won't get into.
Okay.
But you document your methods in the code, and then you have a separate program, depending on the language you're using, to parse through all your code and generate an HTML page.
What?
Yeah. The thing I'm using is called LDoc for Lua projects. But this is really common for JavaScript developers, other languages have their tools of choice that can generate documentation. You still need to write it, but you can write it as comments in your code instead of maintain a separate. It helps things stay in sync.
Yeah, cool.
You still have to run it every time you want to generate this stuff.
But that's a lot easier than copy-pasting.
It makes the job so much easier. Yeah. Now, getting it set up. And that's in my, I think I talked about that in my talk on Noble Engine last year. Mm. But it was absolutely worth it because every time I make a change, and man, the people who have started using it, I can tell they're reading the documentation because the questions they have are born from, I didn't make that clear enough. Or here's a bug that I know is not this, this, or that. This is them talking to me because they read the documentation.
Right, right.
And so it's definitely been very useful for users, but it's also been helpful for me to understand where the bugs really are because the people coming to me with the requests know more than you would if something random happened.
Yeah.
So it pays off in the end.
Yeah. I imagine that folks who work in an open source project are probably more comfortable and likely to use documentation in the way that you're describing, because I'm thinking of like other things. Like I'm thinking of myself when I went when I started. I've been using GameMaker recently, and when I started using GameMaker, I didn't really use documentation until I had an issue. Then I just would Google it and read the stuff I needed to, and then stop reading.
Yeah.
So I'm impressed with people knowing all of the details enough to know that like there's a bug with the code or something.
You know, though your behavior is, I believe, universal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people who use open source software are not always open source advocates.
Sure.
It's people who don't want to pay for libraries.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm included in that.
Yeah.
Right? You cannot, that's a sort of a good thing to realize, is that you cannot make a project like this and expect your users to have the open source spirit.
Yeah.
You don't demand that from them, and you shouldn't expect that from them.
Okay, yeah.
But those users, when they come up with a problem, they have somewhere to go first before they create an issue or contact me.
Right.
You know, it's not perfect, but there's typos and stuff in there I just found today. but having something there, it will save you a lot of trouble and will help you develop the project further.
Sure.
And it gives you some discipline. I think that's really nice. So documentation is good.
Yeah.
The main piece of documentation is a README file.
Okay.
So the way GitHub works is that in the root of your document, you have a markdown document. So that's a text file with formatting called README. And then that just goes on the home page of the project.
Yeah.
So you don't have to maintain that separately. it's the first impression your project has. It's where you put instructions on how to install it. Mm-hmm. It's where you put any advisory notices on, like, don't do this. You know, this is how to get started.
Yeah.
It's where I put, please don't clone this project. Clone the
project
template.
Yep.
It has a link to the online documentation. It also has, it makes a case for the project. Like, why would you need it? Who are you and why do you need this?
Yeah.
Right? Because I think that's one of the things is, like, I will find, oh, this is a really cool looking tool. And then I start using it and I realize, like, oh, this isn't for my use case.
Right.
And that's kind of a bummer. Mm-hmm. So you definitely want users who buy into not just that you're selling them the idea, but that they actually are the right users for it. You want to shoo away folks who would not make good use of it or who they would not be interested in whatever benefits it could provide.
Right.
So that's an important part. And that all happens in the README, the very first impression that you get from folks.
Cool.
And because it's in Markdown, and people who've used Discord know Markdown, it's just the, you put asterisk around for italic, two asterisks for bold.
Yeah, I was not sure what Markdown was.
the little capital tilde tick, for code blocks. That's Markdown.
Okay.
It's a format that's been around for a long time.
Got it.
And what you should get, I think, and this is just because I'm kind of like a fussy person when it comes to like document formatting, is you should get yourself a text editor that can do WYSIWYG Markdown for headings, links, bullet points, so you're not writing it like code. Because I don't like writing big blocks of Markdown. I like putting little things in a Discord message. But when I'm going to write a whole document, I want to actually use it like a word processor.
That makes sense.
The one I use is called Typora. I'll put that in the show notes.
Okay.
It's not a free app, but it's worth it. Mm. But there are free apps out there that do a pretty good job. So I recommend putting a little bit of time into that because, again, it's first impressions. You want to describe things to people in the way that they should be.
Yeah.
And as you work on it, you put on your document writing hat and you start, if you have any experience with that, you kind of know. Because if you're just writing like a plain text message, your instincts don't kick in as to being concise and all that stuff.
Absolutely.
It puts you in that mindset of writing the the page in or the paper in college or whatever.
It's a good way of describing that. Mm-hmm.
So
not a 5-paragraph essay,
right?
We're not going for that.
So a lot. I mean, I think I'm basically covering sort of big picture topics here.
Yeah.
The two things I want to talk about specifically before we move on are GitHub issues and pull requests.
Okay. Oh yeah.
So issue is essentially like a forum thread on your project. And it is very often used that way. I have a question. Here's a problem. This is cool.
Yeah.
Like, has anybody noticed this? Like,
yeah.
It's the same kinds of things you get from any kind of forum. And it works like that. It feels like that when you're using it.
Okay.
But as the maintainer, you can add labels to it. So you can say, oh, this is a bug. This is a feature request. This is a support request. And there's a couple of different tags that are used. That helps you keep track of these things.
But so you specifically have to add those tags?
Yes.
Oh.
No, you or any of other maintainers on your project.
Sure.
So you pretty much to begin with.
Yeah, okay.
And it's useful to keep track of those things. You also can delete them. Mm-hmm. You have a lot of, you have a lot of mod control over it, essentially.
Okay, makes sense.
You can sort it. You can rewrite the topic. So that it makes more sense to other people.
Yeah.
It's different from a forum in that way. You moderate it in a different kind of way.
Sure.
But the thing about GitHub that's interesting is they have this system where everything is tagged with a number. Mm. So every issue is, #7 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And the next #8 is just the next thing that happens on the project.
Mm.
So it could be a pull request. It could be an issue. It could be a forum discussion. There's a bunch of different things. I don't remember all of them off the top of my head, but it's a bunch of things that just use this number, and they just count up sequentially.
Oh,
they're just like a code for a piece of information about your project.
Okay.
When you make a commit in GitHub or in your Git client of choice, you can say, fixes the bug referenced in #16. Now, Git has no idea about, Git the software doesn't know what this is.
Yeah.
But when it's uploaded to GitHub, it knows that a #  means it's part of this system of just simple numbers. Hmm. And whatever 16 is, it'll just link to that.
Oh, that's so cool.
It's really useful because then when someone is browsing through your recent commits, they can click to see what bug was fixed and the whole discussion about that.
That's awesome.
And so taking advantage of this when you write your commit messages and when you create new issues, you can say, I'm referring to this pull request, also part of this numbering system.
Yeah.
And the numbers, as someone who likes to catalog things, having a bunch of different things all share the same like, you know, just append a library.
Yeah.
It's like, it makes me, it's weird. It
does not feel organized.
Yeah.
You but have like a childlike expression of joy on your face as you describe this.
But it's so easy to use.
Yeah.
And because it's so simple. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really, really valuable. And so everything, if you maintain your project on GitHub, it has a bunch of really good tools. It's all tied into this system. And so, you know, an issue will come in, it's a bug, you can assign it to yourself. Mm. Or if you have other maintainers on the project, you can assign it to them. So it's kind of like a Jira ticket, essentially.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a similar system,
the way you
right?
were describing it reminded me.
And GitHub now has Kanban boards. So basically Trello is built right in. And they're based on projects. So you can say this repo is part of this project. And when an issue comes in, I can say assign this to the project Noble Engine. Mm. And it will create an entry in my Trello-like board for me to check on that. And here's the best part. When I close a bug using a commit, I can say it closes the issue in number whatever, and the Kanban board will just automatically update.
Wow.
It's all based on this very simple system that you engage with by typing. Like, it's really, really, it's very intuitive. You do have to maintain good habits with it, I think, to make good use of it.
Mm.
But it's nice because then people visiting the page can know which issues I've deemed are important or have high priority or that I've assigned to myself, or ones that I've, you know, and I could do that by commenting, but it's easier for people to get a glance of where the project stands, how it's moving.
Without having to open up the bug and stuff.
Yeah. And when you have multiple maintainers, it's a good way for people to communicate quickly back and forth because everything needs to be efficient because nobody's getting paid.
Yeah.
So you said you have to maintain some discipline about how you're using it.
Yeah.
But how do you do that across a group of volunteers essentially who aren't, you know,
It's very similar to moderating a Discord channel or a forum, where you grant people access in various levels.
Okay.
So this person can manage issues. This person can push to the repo. And that is totally up to you. If you're just making your own project, all of that is on you.
Right.
And so you don't share that responsibility with anybody. If you do share that responsibility with people, then you sort of have to understand if they have a shared working process. Mm. Because the system has a couple of opinions on how to do things, but it doesn't force anything on you in particular because it's kind of just a broad framework rather than like a workflow exactly.
Okay.
So if you do work with other people, in order to maintain that discipline, you all have to be on the same page on how these things work.
Yeah.
And that comes to the main way that people can contribute, which is to actually write code for your project. And not many, but a couple of people have done that now for Noble Engine. They fixed their own bugs and sent me the code.
Ooh.
It's a great feeling.
Yeah, that's great.
And so the process of that is the last thing I'll talk about is they send in their own commit. They make a branch or they make they fork the project.
Sure.
And we've talked about that in other episodes. And then they submit the pull request, and then they're asking you to pull that into the main branch of the project.
Yeah.
And so this is the other thing that I had to learn a lot about technically, because how am I supposed to test that code?
Yeah.
Right.
Like, yeah. I'm working on the project. It's their fork of the repo. How do I get it without committing it locally and then undoing it? People who know Git know that it's hard to undo things by design.
Yeah.
This is where a lot of your Git clients are not good at this, but GitHub Desktop, which is a Git client that I don't really love, but I use it when I need to do this.
Okay.
Which is it's because it's keyed into the GitHub system.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I will, and pull requests are not unique to GitHub,
right?
But the way GitHub does it is a little unique.
Okay.
And so what I'll do is I will review the pull request in the GitHub Desktop application. Mm-hmm. It will create a branch for me that just has those changes. Switch me to that branch, and then now I can use it in my local project, including in like my submodule projects, like my bigger projects. So I don't need to move any of that stuff around.
Okay.
Test it out, see if it works. It's fine. I can approve it, or reject it, or leave comments because it's part of a pull request has its own forum thread essentially as well.
Ah.
That can be cross-referenced to an issue and back and forth.
Okay, that's cool.
And so if I approve the request, then I can merge it into the main branch, and then I can delete that branch. Hmm. And the person who forked their version, now they have to delete that fork, or they have to pull in their own changes from the official branch or the official one. Hmm. So that's a sort of a separate process if you're someone who's submitting something. And I feel like I've kind of run out of time with this topic, but there is so many technical things. I think if you want to get involved with this, there's the two halves of it. There's two halves apart entirely from actually writing this code, which is the maintaining a presence and using the GitHub system or something similar.
Yeah.
And then also learning about how to just what buttons to press, logistically, how to manage it, we need to manage it.
Yeah.
Because the thing is, a pull request or an issue will pop in at a random time of the day
right.
when I am busy doing something else.
Yeah.
And I want to be responsive, and I am the only person working on it right now. And I want to make sure that people who've invested some time into using it feel that I am paying attention to them.
Yeah.
And that is hard.
Yeah.
And so I would recommend just doing what I did, which is just take 3 days and just read all about it. Mm. If you want to know all the technical details, get things set up and try to maintain those good habits so that I haven't touched it in 2 weeks and then an issue comes up or I have some free time and I want to get around to solving something that's been on the board for a little while.
Yeah.
I can pick up right where I left off without having to reset everything up or sure. having to remember how to do this or that.
Right.
It's,
yeah.
It's that like anything that, you know, like it has to be the kind of thing like riding a bike where you can go a long time without doing it and still remember how it works,
mm-hmm.
which is hard in programming, right?
Yeah, it totally is. I'm imagining myself doing this and I'd be like, I'm not reading anything.
Yeah.
And I'll just start doing stuff and then people will give me requests. I'm like, how do I deal with this? And it'd be a whole mess of project. Yeah.
And the main thing I guess to take away from this is to know this about it.
Yeah.
That it requires that. It isn't that hard once you figure it out.
Right, right. But you just have to spend
Time. And if it's a big hassle every time, then you should probably do some foundational learning about it to make sure that, or, you know, maybe you should not bother yourself with it.
That's true too.
But that's the other thing about it is that you need to let everybody know that you are only human.
Yeah.
And I've had a couple of conversations with some enthusiastic supporters that tried to get my attention a little bit too much and started to feel a little bit neglected when I didn't get back to them in the next day.
Oh, goodness.
And said some things.
Wow.
It happens, right?
Okay. Yeah.
And other people who have been absolutely shocked that I got back to them within a week and so pleased.
Yeah.
Like, it really runs the gamut, right?
Yeah.
But it's important to be not just open with your code, but open with your intent. Let people know that you're working on this week, or let people know that, hey, FYI, I'll keep checking in. I'll make sure I'll maintain. I'll check your pull requests. But just so you know, it's going to be a while before I get back to this.
Okay.
Like in any opportunity, any venue, you have to say that. And that can include just making your own issue, just saying, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But also answering people's questions. When they say like, hey, what about this feature? Say, oh, that's a great idea. But also tell them, but I'm probably not going to get to it for a while.
Sure.
Or, hey, check out this part of the project if you want to help me build that feature.
Yeah.
Like, be encouraging, but also just be really honest.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because you have to set other people's expectations. Because I tell you, I have started work with other people's open source projects that I got really excited about. I hit a brick wall on them at some point, that something that I could not continue unless it was fixed.
Yeah.
And then I realized that the project's not being maintained anymore.
Oh,
and,
no.
And that's not anybody's fault.
Right. Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's my fault most of all.
Yeah.
But if there was more availability, if I could better understand that was the state of the project,
yeah.
or that the developer either moved on or they didn't have time. And it's not, again, they gave the code away. They don't know, they don't owe you anything else,
mm-hmm.
Technically. If I could understand that better, then I would make a more informed judgment as to whether to use it. So
yes.
The more open and honest you are, the more likely people are going to take a risk on using your code, on being dependent on your code.
Right.
And so there's a lot of things to consider.
Yeah, that's good to know. That's very good to know. I'll have to keep that in mind.
And when you use open source projects, you know, give a thought to all the effort it takes, not just to write the stuff.
Yeah, that's good. Also good to know. I like that.
Yeah.
Be nice.
Good rule of thumb.
So yeah, there are places you can follow us and hang out with us.
Yes.
We've got Twitter.
We do.
We also have a Discord channel.
Yeah.
And you can join it by going to nicegames.club/discord. But why would someone do that? Well, because it's cool to hang out with people like us and also a whole bunch of other listeners.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing is, like, you know, whenever there's a new episode that comes out, usually we post a link in the chat and someone will have some questions about it or responses to something or hot takes. And it kicks
I mean,
up.
Yawn. Then there's got to be more.
Like maybe lukewarm takes too, but no. And then usually there's like this whole organic discussion that kind of cascades out of that. And then sometimes you get random stuff like what are people posting? I don't understand. Like, people are talking. I completely lost track of the conversation. I stopped watching the chat for like 2 days, and now I don't even understand. There's a Klingon pulling up candles. There's like music stuff.
Yeah, someone who regularly frequents the Discord posted music that they've made recently.
Oh man.
Really cool.
Oh yeah, that song's a banger.
Yeah.
I do see.
Just say, go. I mean, we could put it in the show notes, and maybe that would be the nice thing to do. But tell you what, if you go to nicegames.club/discord, you can find it right there.
Yeah.
I'm gonna pin it to the top of the channel right there now.
Go. Sounds good.
I don't think I have that privilege.
Yeah, we'll figure it out. We'll have it pinned, and you'll be able to listen to it.
We finally figured out how to exploit our audience.
About time.
Yeah.
Come hang out with cool people on our Discord. Ha ha.
Nicegames.club/Discord.
Okay, how do I get into this topic?
What's a killer, Ellen? I'm just going to ask that right off because I don't know what that means.
This has been on the board for like a couple of weeks.
Right. And it's real awkward because it's the name. What I assume when you say killer, you don't mean literal.
Right.
Yeah. We're not talking about a murder spree.
Well, sort of, kind of not.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So this goes back to this this theory developed by Richard Bartle.
Uh-huh.
Which was developed a while ago and has gone through some additional iterations. But the original theory had like four different player types that he observed in MUDs, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is like, you know, the forerunner to MMOs. And the idea is that there are these four player types, and they exist across different axes. There are these four axes of acting and interacting. And then there is a separate horizontal axis of world and players.
Okay.
So if you are someone who likes to interact, if you're on the interacting spectrum or side of the spectrum and you're on the player side of the spectrum, then you are a socializer. So you like interacting with other players.
Yeah. Okay.
If you are on the player side of the spectrum and you like acting on other players, you are a killer because you are exerting control over them.
Oh.
Right? The other two types we've got. You know, I mentioned socializers, I mentioned killers. There's achievers who like acting on the world, right? Mm-hmm. So they're, you know, exerting their presence on the world. Sure. And then there are explorers who are interacting with the world.
Ah, okay.
So, yeah. So then there was a bunch of other, like, literature and, I think, research. And I'm not an expert on this by any means. And I think that the idea of this quadrant, and I think he eventually expanded it to like eight player types, but I'm not going to get into that because I'm really just focused on killers today.
Okay.
I'm just giving some background. So there's been additional research. There's been additional like thought leadership around this idea.
Sure.
Another piece of thought leadership that has come around this idea of Bartle's player types is like, when does it not apply?
Yeah.
And one of the things he has specifically written about is how it does not apply to gamification.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Like this is a theory about player interactions within a game system and with a game system, mm-hmm. in a specific type of game.
Sure.
Okay.
Right. So it's not something you can just stamp onto other types of games. Although I do want to come back to that because I think there are some ways that we could think about the idea of what a killer is in different contexts.
Okay.
But yeah, so that's the root of it. We've got these four player types. They have different axes. I'll link to some stuff in the show notes. You can read it on your own. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there are the socializers and the explorers and the achievers. We love the badges. And then there are the killers. And they just drive me nuts.
And that's the root of this topic.
Yeah.
And really, that is the root of the topic is, yeah, why the heck do we even bother with these folks? Right? Okay. So let me explain a little bit more because I do want to come back to that question. And I do want to actually have a real conversation about why.
Yeah.
But like the reason this became a topic is because I kind of connected the dots on some things and realized that I didn't have a good answer for that question. So first of all, the first thing that I've noticed is, you know, you go to any online like big MMO game.
Yeah.
Whether it's an ancient relic like World of Warcraft, or something like up and coming like Day of Dragons is one that I've been playing a little bit on and off because I think I'm part of their testing and whatever.
Sure.
They have like PvP servers and they have PvE servers.
Yeah.
Right. So if you don't want any interaction with those rascally killers, you go to a PvE server. Mm-hmm. And then but you also go to a PvP server. So to me, that communicates two things. One, I'm not alone in not wanting to deal with those people. But two, there are enough of them that they do warrant some sort of attention within the development of a product.
Right. Okay.
I could almost preempt the irritation by saying, well, aren't there just games that invite killers and only killers? And wouldn't that be okay?
Well, I don't know. Okay, this actually brings back to something we were talking about before we even started recording today.
Uh-huh.
And that's that quote from Westworld. In order for someone to win, someone else has to lose.
Right?
Like, I don't really... Like, there are some games that I like playing that way. But here's the thing that makes, like, the experience of being on the other end of a killer way more frustrating. Like, okay, so you're playing your game and you're doing your thing. You've got your gameplay loop. You've got your goal in mind and you're going through and you're doing it. And wham, someone comes across and just takes you out. And then they just, like, keep killing you over and over again.
Yeah.
Or they bother you enough to interrupt what you were doing. But then they run away and you can't kill them. And that's something I observed when I was watching my husband Eric and one of his friends play Elden Ring.
Yeah.
Because they got invaded and this guy just kept, like, running. Just kept running. They couldn't get him.
Oh, good.
And then he tried to run them into a bunch of mobs, like big crab or snail things. Mm-hmm. And it was just the most, it just completely derailed their game for like 15 minutes. And it wasn't even that exciting of a fight at the end. Like, they eventually cornered the guy and they had to fight. And I think he took them both out, but it wasn't, like, exciting in any way. Yeah, it was just like...
Right. It's meant to be an asymmetrical gameplay experience. But I've almost heard nobody get excited about being on that side of it.
Exactly. And that's the crux of my question is, like, I think I've had one experience where I was on the receiving end of a killer's attention and it ended up being an awesome experience. And the reason it was an awesome experience is because I was a tiny little level 50 druid in World of Warcraft, but my boyfriend at the time was a guild leader for one of the best rating guilds on the server.
Oh.
And so all of the guild was totally decked out. And so when I went into guild chat and I was like, help, my friend and I are getting ganked. Like 30 of these, like, epic and legendary geared people showed up in this tiny little backwater region of the map and just killed the guy, killed him again, killed the flight master, killed the griffins, like completely wiped the map of the opposite faction.
What's funny about that is that that's you exercising your killer instinct.
I didn't want to, though. I didn't start this.
Yes, but your smile is not abating.
No, I didn't start it, but I sure as hell ended it.
Okay.
So my friend and I, we just went back to doing our little questy bits.
Yeah,
like, and that's all I wanted to do in the beginning. And so I think that is the one experience I've ever had where the interaction I had with the killer was ultimately positive for me. Otherwise, it's just frustrating. I quit. I stop playing. I just stop being fun to kill. I get boring. And that's not fun for me. So why do we even let them do that?
It's sort of interesting because I have this core criticism of competitive games, but a lot of times in order for it to be fun enough to play,
mm-hmm.
you have to have that kind of winner and loser.
Mm-hmm.
And the ideal experience is where everyone wins and loses just about the same amount, or rather everyone's above average, you know, and can feel good about themselves. It's a zero sum game, I guess, but or you could improve, you could be, you know, on the losing end for a long time and get better and better and better. But I think that's such a tricky balance. Like, I don't like that kind of setup, but I kind of recognize that there's no way around it. Like, there's just too many games that couldn't exist without that being a core. I don't know, Steven, you like winners and losers in your games.
I do indeed. So all of this reminded me a lot of Deathloop. And like the way that Deathloop works is if you're playing, there's actually two modes of play in that game.
Mm-hmm.
You can either play as Cole, who's like the main character, and he's the one who's trying to figure out why the loop is happening, trying to stop the loop. And you could play as Juliana, who is trying to kill Cole, in their individual games. It's all online, and like I think actually most people play as Cole, so like Juliana players just kind of sit there for a long time. It's not a great experience. I played it once and I was like, I don't like this. But
is that a requirement of that game? Is that character always played by another human?
No, sometimes it's played by AI.
Okay.
Because I think not enough, like I said, a lot of people are playing Cole.
Right.
Not enough people are playing as Juliana. But as a result of how that works, if Juliana does not show up in your game, Cole's just, you know, you've developed a plan at this point probably, and you're just executing on that plan. And it's relatively simple to do that if you understand how the AI works. And like the AI is not that complicated. I mean, it's obviously complicated, but not like ridiculously so complicated that like you can't solve it.
Mm-hmm.
And so like you'll just, you know, execute on a plan and then you'll just move on to the next part of the day. But when Juliana shows up, then the Cole player has to adapt and react to what the Juliana player is trying to do. And then the Cole player has three tries to like defeat Juliana before Juliana defeats him.
Mm-hmm.
But it changes up the dynamic of the game while she's in play. So I think, and if you're a Juliana player, it sounds like you would end up being, you would be a killer in that, like, you want to, you know, kill Cole, and that's the only thing you could do, really. You're not trying to solve any problems. You're not trying to break any loops. You're not trying to understand lore or story or anything like
right.
that. So I think in that game in particular, it does work because, like, I found that my plans were ruined whenever Juliana showed up, but, like, it can still be an exciting game. It didn't always end up being the case because sometimes I'd just, like, be way better, or sometimes I just wouldn't be able to figure out where Juliana was and I would just get wrecked.
That tension or fear even is a good part of the experience.
Yeah, it's interesting and compelling.
Hmm. Yeah.
So, like, it worked, and that game was, you know, it was designed around that experience. Mm-hmm. So, like, it worked out in that. I don't really play MMOs, so I can't quite justify why MMOs have PvP versus PvE, but I mean, I imagine that, I don't know, it's sort of like a skill check based thing. Like, you want to prove that you have a good understanding and knowledge and have worked so hard to get to this part or to get to this level in the game that you want to prove to other people that you've done that.
I don't know, post some cool screenshots of your awesome gear.
You know,
I'm being facetious.
I have a cynical theory about MMOs.
Sure.
Which is that if you're someone who's really into it,
yeah.
Eventually you'll run out of environment.
Yes.
And what you know?
That's endgame. Hmm. Yeah.
What more mountains are there to scale?
Yes.
And so that's just a cheap way to provide more experience, more content.
That is a very good point, and I think you're absolutely correct. I think that's a lot of the because I oftentimes find myself when I play an MMO. I have played a lot of MMOs at this point, but I never get very far because I don't find myself fitting in a community or whatever.
Yeah.
Or I get bored or something. Mm-hmm. But like my ultimate goal kind of is to get to the end where I could do the cool raids or do PvP stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I never get that far, but that would be a cool motivation for me. And it'd be a motivation to interact between guilds and stuff too.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that those games are designed around that kind of idea that the end game is once you've done the raids, the end game, and you have your cool gear and whatever, the end game is just to do PvP.
I think it would be, and I don't know what games employ a system similar to this, but where, like you say, you could have guilds and they could just organize an intramural battle this afternoon.
It sounds like Eve.
Right, so everyone in the, you know, PvP area is participating in that multiplayer battle experience.
Right.
But then I guess you have the choice not to, right? So
yeah.
Is there something thrilling about being in the danger zone? Like you're doing your quests or you're grinding, and it's kind of interesting that there's could be someone with an axe nearby.
Yeah, that might be a part of it.
It's a sense of thrill.
Yeah,
like I was saying with Deathloop.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that totally makes sense. And to kind of argue against myself, like I do think, you know, there is a slightly different flavor of your mentality that comes to mind when you click on a PvP server.
Yeah.
Right. And it depends on the game, like the exact nature of the flavor and what comes into that, like. In like a survival game, if you're doing PvP, if you get killed, you might lose all your stuff.
Yeah,
right. Not so the case in something like World of Warcraft. And there is something also interesting, I think, about how a game that allows for PvP does allow, like, handles the end of the interaction.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this is one of the things that I think that maybe the Soulsborne games do pretty well, and Elden Ring 2, is that they don't let the person just kind of linger in your world.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, you're dead and you move on. Now, there's still the issue of, like, it's a big world and so they can lead you on a merry chase and waste your time.
Right.
But they're, you know, it's a little different than, like, okay, you're, you know, being camped in the middle of this zone and there's no one around because it's, like, the hinterlands, literally.
Yeah.
And... So, and they're just killing you over and over again.
Right.
I don't really see any redeeming qualities in that. And there have been systems that, like, I think World of Warcraft has implemented to try to help with that. But I don't think that it's like, it's a lot of the behavior is not coming from like a desire to seek out honor kill points to get your PvP gear.
You know, it's funny because as you were describing, like, the scenario where someone invades and then runs away, so they maintain their status as a threat to you, and that's so annoying. That instinct of, like, beating or humiliating or humbling the other player comes from that exploitative mechanic. So any system designed to make it less appealing to that killer sensibility is going to be not fun for the killer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And so and they know like that, like, well, you know, I could lose this encounter. So how do I do something that I can still, damn the rules of the game.
Yeah.
Right.
And so when you encourage that kind of attitude and then try to blunt it with, you know, balancing mechanics, the people who you've encouraged to feel this way will find every way around it. And so
it's part of the point.
I'm with you. We should not bother making games for these people.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know. It's just so interesting. But on the other hand, like, there is something tantalizing. I think this is, you know, the point you were trying to, one of the points you were making, Stephen, is that there is something tantalizing
about
the possibility of someone popping up.
Yeah. You know?
Like, and here's the thing is, like, if I'm just like my level 20 druid hanging out in some zone and then somebody rides by with their awesome epic mount and they have a skull and I can't even, way above my level, they can kill me really fast. And then they probably just move on with their day. And that doesn't sound actually terrible because it is like, oh my gosh, they just popped up. I mean, I didn't even know. Yeah. And it kind of being able to have that encounter doesn't feel terrible. It's the persistent harassment. I don't feel like harassment's probably the wrong word, but maybe it's the right word. It's the persistent harrying when someone just hounds you over and over again.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't really know how you deal with that, except for something like the Soulsborne games where they just cut you off.
Yeah,
and even then, you know, like sometimes there's nobody playing, so you just keep trying to you keep going to someone else's world and you end up in the same person's world over and over again.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
There's no one else online. But like, yeah, I think that the thing that makes it really frustrating to me and maybe players who share my sensibilities, I guess, is that it's not over fast. I can't get back to the gameplay loop
quickly. Yeah.
I don't mind failure if I get to try again really fast.
You know, it's interesting because I think you can get all those, as the player on the receiving end of danger, you can get all those feelings from AI-controlled systems.
Yeah, you can.
So I'm thinking about Assassin's Creed Origins, I think. That might be in some of the other games, where if at a certain point, there could be, I don't remember what they're called. I wish I did. But they're like super hunters who know you're around and come after you.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And they are, you have to run away from them.
Yeah.
I mean, you can take them on, but like it does require you to completely pivot from your activities to deal with that threat.
Right.
Or you can sort of pivot from your activities to evade that threat.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty interesting mechanic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That could easily be a player invasion system because the idea is that the challenge is, I mean, you could give a player coming in better weapons or more armor or whatever to make that unbalanced. But that fear that it is supposed to be, you know, the they're out to get you, that I think that works just as well, even though it doesn't have a player brain behind it. So maybe you don't have the same sort of like satisfaction outwitting an AI.
Well, so
or unpredictability.
But my point is that, you know, theoretically you could make that feel as good as, or feel like it's a person invading your game.
Yes.
But where it breaks down is when you have that other person's motivations getting in the way of that perfect system, right? Of like trying to grief the other player.
Right, yeah.
Or matches being, you keep getting matched up with the same person and both of you are bored of it. Mm-hmm. So somebody decides to do something stupid and the other person's not into it.
Yeah.
Like they don't go to the same place of fun together, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think you can still get those things in other ways, but it's about providing the killer with that experience of being a killer.
Yeah.
And it's still, you can still have the things those systems give you without needing to satisfy that killer instinct.
Well, I will say that I have an issue, frankly, with the name killer, because it implies that you're actively trying to kill another person. And I mean, most of the time that's how it pops up in the games, right? But
so you just talked yourself out of this argument.
No.
Okay.
What I was going to say is that you can get the same satisfaction out of just outsmarting someone else.
Yeah.
Right.
It doesn't have to be just killing.
Well, that's like he's a killer, you know. It's not.
Oh, I know.
It's meant, you know, someone who is, you know, out for blood, ready to win.
Right.
You know?
But I'm what I'm suggesting is that like outsmarting someone.
Take no prisoners.
He's got
another
more.
One. He's got one more.
No, that's it. I'll save it for later.
Okay, cool. And when I start talking.
Yeah, yeah.
but well, I think outsmarting someone is it's still just about as satisfying for a killer as it, and is less detrimental to other players who are not interested in that kind of gameplay.
Yeah.
So I think that like that kind of aspect, like it'd be one thing, like I think what you're saying, what you've said before, Ellen, makes sense, where that like your entire game plan is ruined and you have to like completely derail what you were doing in order to deal with this thing, and you might fail, and then it'll take you forever to get back to where you were.
Yeah,
that's all like a huge detriment to somebody else.
I've got half an hour per day to play games. Like, I don't want to. No.
Yeah, you don't want to have to deal with that.
That's why I don't play that type of game anymore.
But if this thing, if the killer just like slows you down, slows down your momentum, so that your 30-minute gameplay is maybe 45 minutes. I mean, it's not great still, but like, it's you know, it slows you down, but you're still able to progress.
Yeah,
I think that the killer can still get some satisfaction out of outsmarting the player or slowing them down. And you're not completely ruining the game for another person.
Hmm.
So yeah, I think, because that's kind of how I think about it with respect to Deathloop. I think that, well, if you could, I think like a whole day, you know, the game takes place in four different times during the day.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a whole day doesn't take that long when you have an idea on how you're going to execute the plans. It's pretty fast.
Yeah.
Even if you're not like trying to speedrun or anything like that, like, because like you get really good weapons when you fight it long enough. But when Juliana shows up, like she will end up ruining that specific attempt that day, but it's not that bad. It's mm-hmm. not that big of a detriment.
Mm-hmm.
I think it just sucks in the moment, but then you just get back into it and you can like get more stuff down the line. So I think just figuring out ways to make the consequences of a killer less affecting for other players would make.
Well, sometimes aren't some games that do this, if you take out the killer who invades your space, you get some reward that would otherwise be denied you. So there's some method of like...
Well, there's that benefit too.
It throws you off your game, but there's an opportunity for something.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and then the player and the other player and the killer are playing effectively at the same level. And it kind of does that in Deathloop, except Juliana only has one life, whereas Cole has three.
Yeah.
So Juliana has to kill Cole three times. But you get like pretty good rewards for killing her.
Right.
So, I think that helps motivate, both players to
you know,
fight each other.
Cause I think the problem is like, I'm okay with a game being so hard that I couldn't reach the challenge, but I don't like the idea of somebody else stopping me from it.
Sure.
You know, it's a psychological thing rather than a mechanical thing.
I think that's fair though.
Yeah.
And so even offering those rewards for avoiding that hurt,
mm-hmm.
It can only get you so far
in
terms of making it feel worth your time.
Oh, sure.
You know?
Yeah, I think that makes sense. But yeah, I guess I would just implore folks to think about it, not necessarily as people taking away from other folks, but just like it being a different style of play. I think that's what this Bartle thing was proposing.
Yeah, it was.
It's just a different style of play.
Right. And that wasn't like, I don't think that was part of his original thesis, was like, there are these four types and one of them is useless.
Right.
Right. I think there was some, you know, there was some literature talking about like what the balance is, because they're not intended to be represented in equal portions.
Right. And all these examples we've been coming of is when you throw people of a different type together.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then you try to mechanically have them both achieve their own goals.
Right.
And there could be one fails, but I think when you're faced with a killer and you're not a killer, in order to defeat them, you have to become a killer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just for a brief moment.
Right.
Or just be really good at escaping.
Right.
Which is my favorite tactic.
You can't really like lean hard into your quadrant and succeed.
Yeah.
Well, if you're an explorer and you know all the places you can go to hide.
Oh, okay.
I suppose so.
I suppose that's fair.
That's why they're on opposite ends of corners.
Well, that's the future of making this balance work, mm-hmm. is by letting people like really like what they've enjoyed so far.
Mm-hmm.
It should be a test of that.
Yeah.
That's easier said than done, of course.
Right? Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, I think that some of the things that we've discussed as possible solutions to that, you see them in the games, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
limiting the amount of time they can come back and get you, maybe limiting the amount of time they can even bother you, depending on how you set up your game. Having like a timer afterwards where they don't get to hit you any again would be maybe nice.
Right.
The other thing that's interesting is just like there's just like so many different types of PvP games out there right
mm-hmm.
now, like fighting games, like the classic stuff, but like battle royale games obviously have become huge.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe the issue of should killers, you know, how do you design so that killers can have fun without ruining the fun of everyone else? Maybe that's not as much of a question anymore because people aren't playing those games as much. I'm not sure.
Mm. Yeah.
Something to look into. Also, I still don't like them. Good conversation. I still don't like.
Glad we had that. Yeah.
No holds barred. Yeah.
There's another one.
I will, as nicely as I possibly can say.
That's a great coda for the episode.
That's our show. For show notes and links on today's topics, go to our website, nicegames.club. Visit us on Twitter at nicegamesclub, where Dale tweets about game dev resources and self-explanatory features. We like hearing from you, so tweet back. Or email us, contact@nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. And if you want to keep things more casual, just stop by nicegames.club/discord and listen to that song we told you to listen to.
It's a banger, I'm telling you.
It really is. But that's it for this week.
So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.